Welcome to the Phil Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 12:52 PM, that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is August 24th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, we've had a number of interesting news items coming through in here, particularly today, because Jay Powell was speaking at Jackson Hole, and then today the Chinese used the opportunity to try and support the currency. So they call that an asymmetric move or a counter-cyclical intervention. We can also see that this is potentially a higher reaction low for the renminbi, that the consistency of the trend evidence since the middle of April has been compromised. Additional follow-through on Monday would break the progression of higher reaction lows. So this is a potentially important move. I think we get a little bit more intelligence when we look at it on a weekly basis, because this is the largest rally that we've seen for the renminbi in months, and it's from the region of the peak in the dollar that we saw against the renminbi back in 2016. So this is a natural area where we can anticipate some support being found. The Chinese markets were in need of a catalyst. They needed something to really demonstrate that the administration was paying attention, and that we weren't going to see the renminbi continue to fall in such an alarming fashion. The one, I think, compelling argument for why the Chinese would not let their currency deteriorate in a straight line, at least, is capital flight. Capital flight is the biggest threat to China. They do whatever they can to arrest the pace of capital flight from the country, for the simple fact that in a highly controlled system like China has, where you have the government, the banks, and property developers all working in concert, and infrastructure development as well, to try and sustain the economy and high property prices. That's all predicated on access to liquidity and the ability of banks to borrow against their large deposit base. Well, if people start moving their money overseas, then that impacts the deposit base and increases the leverage in the rest of the economy, and that's the kind of environment that can cause crises. So China does not want to have any kind of capital flight. That's why they came down so heavily on Bitcoin and the cryptocurrencies, and it's also why they have been closing loopholes to moving money overseas. So what it does suggest right now is that at least we have a peak of at least near-term significance for the dollar. And considering that this is dollar renminbi, it is a significant enough currency pair that it's likely to have an impact on other emerging market currencies. So that's potentially important, and we'll look at that in a moment. But it's also worth taking a look at what's going on in the Chinese market. So, for example, the A-share index was in mildly positive territory in here today. And it has been pausing around this 2,800-point level over the course of the last 5 weeks. But when we look at it on a weekly basis, well, we get a lot more intelligence. There has been significant technical deterioration. And so far, this downward break that we saw earlier this week has not failed. It really does need to follow through on the upside next week to, I think, check the momentum. The reality is that China's markets are laboring under the fact that they've been leaning very heavily on the shadow banking sector. And one of the other points, of course, is that the quantity of debt that has been issued in US dollars over the course of the last few years has ballooned to approximately $450 billion. Now, as a percentage of the total size of the Chinese economy, that's not particularly large, but from the perspective of international investors, that's rather a large figure. It could have a much bigger impact on the creditors than it does on the debtor nation. But the reality is that when we look at the banking sector at least the listed component of the banking sector. It did respond today reasonably positively to the strength of the renminbi. There is a progression of higher reaction lows, and that the pace of the decline has moderated, and this is potentially support building. Well, it has some work to do in order to repair the technical deterioration we've seen, but I think it is important to also highlight that this is not a consistent trend, that it has been incredibly volatile, and that it is prone to these very serious pullbacks. So we have a low of at least near-term significance. The most likely scenario is that we are going to get a process of mean reversion, and about half of that has already been completed. Then we'll ask bigger questions about whether it can really sustain a move back above the trend mean. But the support for the currency is certainly a positive development. Well, if we then look at the Asia Dollar Index, then this is also important because it is very oversold, and most particularly relative to the trend mean. And now, with the renminbi starting to steady up, this today's rally has broken that very short-term progression of lower rally highs. So this is at least a low of near-term significance and potentially medium-term significance for Asian currencies. Well, I've been paying particular attention to, for example, the Indonesian rupiah, which was very quiet in here today, but is still at its lows. And the Indian rupee, well, that is an outside day rather than a key reversal because it was not at a new low in here today. But upside follow-through for the rupee next week would be rather encouraging. Then the currency that had the biggest rally last week was, or this week, sorry, was the Thai baht, and it was stronger again in here today, but it does need to push back above the trend mean, or to see the dollar drop below the trend mean on this chart. When we look at the SET index, then it has bounced from the region of the upper side of that underlying trading range, and it is now right in the region of the trend mean. When we look at that on a long-term basis, that 1600 point level is rather important, considering that it was where the market encountered resistance back in 1993 and 1994. That's an enormously long region for to have significance for markets, but we can see that it did spend a good 4.5 to 5 years ranging below 1600 points, and now it has sustained the move above it. Well, as long as it is sustaining the move above the 1600 point level, I think we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Then, when we look at some of the other regional markets, the Korean market was, in fact, it was the Korea's rather interesting because when people talk about synchronized global economic expansion, they talk about the top 10 economies in the world, and South Korea is the 11th. And it contracted in the last quarter of last year. And that upset the apple cart in terms of synchronized global economic expansion, but it was also something of a lead indicator for some of the more troublesome growth perspective that we've had for most of this year so far. But what I think is interesting is that having failed to sustain the move above 2500 and then come back below the trend mean, that it is stabilizing in the region of those peak values that we saw back in 2011. This is about where we could anticipate support being found if this is still a generally benign environment. So when we look at what is going on in Asia in particular, I think there is room for some additional I think enthusiasm that this medium-term correction that has been underway now for most of the year so far may be coming towards the we may be coming to the end of that. So I think that's, we've seen a number of articles this week talking about bargain hunting in the emerging markets. I'm very hesitant to say emerging markets because when you look at emerging market indices or funds, they are heavily dominated by China, Brazil, and Russia. And despite the fact that you've had some strength coming through in the renminbi and you have oversold conditions, the reality is that the Brazilian real is still quite weak, and it did not really rally in anything close to an impressive manner in here today. There are significant questions about the outcome of its election, and those are not going to be answered by anything that happens with the renminbi. Then, if we look at the South African rand, it was a bit firmer in here today. It did get down to a low of 15.5 at the beginning of this month, and it is unwinding some of that over sold condition. But right now, if we think about what, where, or how do we define governance, property rights are under threat in South Africa, and you have an independent judiciary and you have an independent or a free press, but property rights are, and most particularly minority shareholder interests, are something that is rather sacrosanct from the perspective of international investors. And it's under threat in South Africa right now. Now, the big question, of course, and one can argue back and forth indefinitely about whether, in fact, South African landowners have or freeholders have a right to their land. But if you start taking land away from people without due process, then where does it stop? That's the question. That do you then are we on the cusp of a spiraling deterioration in governance? That's a big question. And the fact of the matter is that the dollar has now broken its progression of lower rally highs against the South African rand, and a sustained move back below the trend mean would be required to question the dollar dominant environment over the medium term. And I think these are the questions that are going to be answered over the course of the next while, that we can continue to view the markets from a governance perspective. And as we get the rise of populism, and I continue to think that populism is a direct symptom of the fact that we've had extraordinary monetary policy, which achieved its stated goal of inflating asset prices, but did not succeed in in delivering the anticipated trickle-down effect. And that has contributed to a widening gap between those that have benefited from extraordinary monetary policy and those that have not. And the rise of populism, whether that is manifested as the Me Too movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, anti-immigration, xenophobia, the rise of populism in terms of the demands for greater social services, lower taxes, or higher taxes on the wealthy. Every one of those shares the I think the abiding characteristic that it is a symptom of a revolt against the status quo. And it is that revolt against the status quo that is infecting not just one market, it's a global phenomenon. And it's a global phenomenon for the simple reason that in a globalized economy, capital is both global and mobile. And the result of quantitative easing has been that it has inflated asset prices everywhere. And that is a significant question. We do not, or it is almost impossible to quantify the extent to which those asset prices have been affected by quantitative easing. That is probably not a question that could be answered until after they start to come back down again. And then the question is, well, if is that an awfully big assumption that they will start to come back down again, or is it inevitable? That's again another question that is conjecture at this stage, but is not is probably something that's going to be answered over the course of the next 5 years. Well, These are big long-term questions, and when we think about that, well, the voting machine is the market, and the bond market is a lot larger than the stock market. And US 10-year Treasury yields are close to, again, 2.81%. This represents the region of the lower side of the range that's been forming now for most of this year, and it's approximating the region of the trend mean. Well, the bond market is suggesting that, and certainly when we listen to what Jay Powell had to say today, and I think it is interesting that the parallels between his speech today and the same kinds of questions that the Federal Reserve was asking in 1998. There was something else that happened in 1998 and I posted an article in Comment of the Day today that was not mentioned in the article, but it was the yield curve first became inverted in 1998, and the market did not peak until 2000. So that is a, I think, a very important I think signal that the stock market can continue to rise well after the yield curve becomes inverted. But what we need to bear in mind is that in the event that the yield curve does become inverted, not to ignore the signal. And the yield curve today is now at 19 basis points. Well, it's not that long ago it was at 50 basis points. The pace of the decline is accelerating. And we can also, and I'll just highlight for you that it was very briefly in 1998 when the yield curve became inverted. Then it became sharply inverted again right at the beginning of 2000 because the pace of the Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes really started to pick up. If we remember that it was Alan Greenspan who talked about irrational exuberance, and that but that was a couple of years before the market in fact peaked. Well, I think these are rather interesting parallels because back in the 1990s, everyone was worried, or perhaps worried is the wrong expression. Everyone was extremely excited about the productivity growth that was coming through from new technologies in the telecommunications sector, and most particularly from the internet. Well, now people are more worried about deflationary impacts from technology. I would really hesitate to draw that conclusion because if we look at simply rather than theory examples, it is the countries that have embraced technology and automation are the ones that are among the centers for global manufacturing. It's the countries that have not embraced automation are those that have seen their manufacturing sectors wither. And the reality is that by creating a global workforce, that has contributed to a leveling of the field in terms of wages. So it is in fact globalization which is deflationary, and that it is technology is more the answer to that deflationary environment rather than the cause. Well, what we have had over the last few years has been the impact of extraordinary monetary policy, that has created the kinds of bull markets that were driven by productivity in the 1990s. We've substituted productivity growth for massive productivity growth for massive monetary stimulus. And in the USA, they have now adopted fiscal stimulus in place of monetary stimulus, and that transition has been relatively seamless. So now we're seeing the yield curve starting to come back down. So the Federal Reserve is moderately raising interest rates right now, a quarter of a point every quarter. And they anticipate continuing to do that, but not accelerating. Well, eventually we will have an uptick in inflationary pressures, and then they'll accelerate, and then we'll have a recession. I think that is, the message that we can conclude from the way the market is moving right now. But what that also highlights is that the most likely scenario is that we are now in the third psychological perception stage of what has been an incredibly impressive and persistent bull market since the end of 2008 or the beginning of 2009. The S&P 500 broke out to new highs, or at least posted new highs in here today. We had a massive reaction against the prevailing trend in January, and that contributed to the market being held up for the next 7 months. Well, a medium-term correction can last for anything from 6 to 18 months, and in this case, it was 17 months. Excuse me, 7 months. Well, a clear and sustained move back below the trend mean would be required to question the consistency of the overall uptrend. And this suggests that the possibility is now that we're going to enter an accelerating phase. And it is being led higher by the smaller caps. The Russell 2000 broke emphatically up and out of a short-term range in here today, and it has been among the most consistent movers on the upside since the beginning of 2016. The ranges are one above another, and the consolidations have been relatively short-lived. But now we can also see that it has had a narrower range, a shorter range, and that it has not allowed the price to catch up with the or to pull back to the region of the trend mean, or for the trend mean to catch up. Therefore, the pace of the advance is picking up, and that is obviously a characteristic of the nascent form of acceleration. Well, then we need to take a look at Amazon. Amazon is over 400, well, not quite 400, but $350 overextended relative to the trend mean, and it remains reasonably consistent on the upside. It was in mildly positive territory in here today, but we have one little range above another, and as long as that remains the case, people are probably not going to be overly worried about it. Apple has also been really quite inert and has really done nothing to shake the complacency of the bulls. And Google, which did have that somewhat larger pullback, in fact, it was double the size of a normal pullback, has continued to hold this $1,200 level and bouncing again from it in here this week. So these are the biggest companies in the world, and they are still trending higher in a reasonably consistent manner. And there is the potential that the breadth of the market will improve if this sentiment or if sentiment continues to improve now that we have an increasing number of indices that are breaking on the upside. Well, the Dow Jones is the market that had been really accelerating higher at the end of last year, and it continues to pause below that 26,000 point level. But it has held a progression of higher reaction lows since the beginning of April, and this continues to look like a generally benign environment. Well, if this medium-term correction on Wall Street has ended, then the Wall Street leash effect is, and the fact that Wall Street is continuing to do well, it is by far the largest of the capital markets, that is likely to act as a t or a it's likely to pull up emerging markets, where people will look at the valuations on Wall Street and think, well, golly, I could pay this valuation on Wall Street, or I can get a discount for buying things that don't look that haven't been quite as attractive until now elsewhere. And that's likely to constitute increased investor interest in the emerging markets, but I think most particularly in Asia over the course of the next few months, where they do have the potential to unwind some of the rather deep pullbacks that we have seen. Now, if we look at the FANG index, I think one of the most important points is that it has had a narrowing of breadth. And It has certainly firmed in here today, and it is finding support in the region of the upper side of that underlying range. Well, if we look at the constituents of the index, well, Apple, Amazon, and Alphabet represent about 35% of the index. But Netflix, Tesla, Facebook, and Alibaba have, and Twitter have all pulled back pretty sharply over the course of the last few months. So it really is worth keeping an eye on those shares because some of those are rather new technology. Netflix, though, has bounced emphatically from the region of the trend mean in here this week. And that is a rather bullish characteristic, that it was really quite overextended, it was due a pullback, it has had the pullback, and today's move is really rather encouraging. It has now broken that short-term progression of lower rally highs, and it had the upside key reversal on Monday and has spent the rest of the week following through on the upside. So if and I have on multiple occasions considered both Netflix and Tesla as the canaries in the coal mine in terms of the kinds of companies that have benefited most from quantitative easing, and the kinds of companies that benefit in a very low interest rate environment are those that go out and borrow a pile of money, and then they take a leveraged bet on whether they can grow to a point where they can generate positive net cash flows before the money needs to get paid back. And for those that can achieve that, well, they are going to be able to survive, and those that can't will go bankrupt. Well, Netflix bouncing is certainly getting a vote of confidence from investors that it has a product that will do well. And Tesla continues to pause around the $300 level. This does not look the same as Netflix. If we were simply comparing the two charts without any ticker or identifying markers, we could very clearly see that Tesla is a more consistent trend. It has gone up more recently than Tesla has. In fact, Tesla looked more like Netflix did back in 2013 through to the end of 2014, and since then it has been very difficult, and it really does need to hold that $300 level. There are substantial questions outstanding about Tesla's finances, not to mention all of the questions about the whether Elon Musk is going to be subpoenaed. So if we then look at what is going on in terms of high yield spreads, they continue to remain inert. And what that suggests is that there is no panic in the bond markets right now. There is nobody particularly worried about the ability of high yield companies to access capital. And the fact that government bond yields are reasonably contained, and in fact are back testing the lower side of their range. Well, that is also good news for the high yield sector. So there is the realistic possibility that we are going to enter an accelerated pace of advance in stock markets, and that that will represent the third and final stage of what has been a incredibly impressive bull market so far. If that's the case for Wall Street, well, we have to consider that leaders lead for a reason, and well, we know what the reason is, that the USA was the first country to adopt extraordinary monetary policy. Then it also forced its banks to realize their debts and write them off, and that has already been completed. And then it has now transitioned from monetary policy stimulus to fiscal policy stimulus. Well, we know that that fiscal policy is going to have to get paid for sooner or later, but the market currently tends to be betting that that's going to be later rather than sooner. The S&P 500 Banks Index remains in a reasonably consistent uptrend, and it rallied 4 weeks ago to break its progression of lower rally highs since the beginning of this year. So what that suggests is that we're still in a trending environment. The rather different trend that we have in European banks suggests that, and I think that that is representative of the challenges facing the European economy. Well, while the USA is engaged in fiscal stimulus, the ECB is just about to start reducing. They're going to stop buying new bonds. That suggests that they're probably going to hold the size of their balance sheet steady for the foreseeable future. But if we go back to that point that capital is both global and mobile, I think it is important to highlight that central bank balance sheets have already contracted rather substantially. It's the biggest pullback we've seen since 2008. And that is taking money out of the system. Well, if we zoom in a little, we can also see that there is the potential here that it is going to start going back up. And if central bank balance sheets start to increase and potentially go back above 20 trillion, that will lend fuel to speculative interest in assets. So this is an important measure to monitor, because there is the potential that this contraction we've seen since March is potentially about to get broken. Well, if the ECB is not going to be buying more bonds, well, then somebody's going to have to be increasing the size of their balance sheet. Well, that's potentially going to be China, because of the challenges that I've been discussing for much of the last couple of months. And that is certainly holding out the prospect of additional monetary stimulus. And of course, Japan has not stopped continuing to add new stimulus. Well, the Nikkei this week bounced from the region of the trend mean, and it has continued to hold an upward bias since March. Importantly, the second section index, which has historically been a leader and has been pausing over the course of the last few months, continues to hold that 7,000 level. And as long as it's holding the 7,000 area, well, I think that is not going to be a headwind to the outlook for the stock market. Well, Japan has been spending so much time doing not much of anything that there is a lack of belief that it will ever be able to sustain a breakout. The TOPIX index has been ranging more or less below 1700 since 1992. But I think the clear change that we've seen over the last few years is that every single time it got up to that level, it made a new low after approximately 1995. So that changed in 2016 when it put in a higher reaction low and subsequently moved on to a higher high. Well, we're still in this process of consolidation, and it is firming now within its range. If it can break out to new high ground, then we would have further confirmation that Japan is back in a secular bull market. And one of the things, and I've mentioned it previously, that I found most surprising about trips to Japan in the last 2 years is the number of foreigners I've encountered. For a country that is, I think, notable for being a monocultural society, the number of foreigners that are immigrants and working is something that is rather surprising. What it says is that Japan is embracing immigration without shouting it from the rooftops. And that immigration is the kind of kickstart to the economy that can really start to get consumption going again, for the simple reason that, generally speaking, when immigrants come in, they are young and hungry for work, and they are buying everything new. They don't get to inherit anything. And that's an important characteristic that Japan has been rather lacking. Well, again, the Nikkei bouncing from the region of the trend mean, but it is outperforming the topics. It is holding this move above 20,000, and this continues to represent a new bull market environment. Now, the Topix Banks Index has been range-bound, but it is potentially now forming a first step above the base. Excuse me, and that's I think the whole range is a first step above the base, and this is potentially a higher reaction low. As long as it is holding that 170 point level, then we can conclude that this is support building. And the potential is that Japan will eventually exit its very lengthy period of deflation. And JGB yields are potentially a picture of that. The Bank of Japan has widened the bands in which they're allowing them to trade, and it already holds the vast majority of the supply. So it's an artificial market for what is effectively a surplus nation. What this chart at least says to me is that yields will gradually move higher, and by that gradually, I think it will take years, but that we're not going to see the yield coming back below zero, and that the most likely scenario is that we're going to have one range above another as the Bank of Japan continues to expand the band that the yield is going to be allowed to trade in. Well, because Europe is almost alone in its determination to end its quantitative easing program, that also helps to illustrate it the fact that it has been underperforming. And the Euro Stoxx index has bounced from the most recent low, and it has held a progression of high reaction lows since April. But it needs to push back above the trend mean, and most particularly, it needs to sustain a move above 400 to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. And that is quite apart from the challenges that remain outstanding, that Europe has got significant challenges, both in terms of its exposure to countries like Turkey, or indeed to China's trade, and then also to the rise of populism within a number of its own markets. And it's not just one, but many of its internal economies, and the competing motivations of those parties, whether they're in Italy or Germany or the Netherlands or Austria or Hungary or Poland, they're not entirely aligned with the European ideals. And when we look at how the pound has been trading versus the euro, it's increasingly pricing in the potential that there is not going to be a deal. And if the UK leaves the euro, or excuse me, the EU, without a customs agreement, then the big question for the UK economy is how aggressive are the lawmakers in Westminster going to be in trying to create a competitive edge for the UK. A lot of the negotiations that have gone on have been really about limiting the ability of the UK to compete, or to compete on regulation with the Eurozone. And the UK has conceded a significant number of issues to protect the interests of the Eurozone. Well, if the UK does in fact leave without a deal, and I continue to think that that is an unlikely scenario, but the currency markets are certainly beginning to price that eventuality in. Well, that is likely to have a deleterious effect on the pound, but also the big question for the UK economy is what are they going to do to improve competitiveness? That is going to require a strong and I think conviction in terms of leadership, and there has been a distinct absence of that over the course of the last few years. I do think that it is unlikely the UK is going to leave the EU without an agreement on customs for the simple reason that the highest paying jobs in the country are at least in part tied to being able to trade with Europe. And that is a significant issue. The one of the I think the most compelling charts is the trend lower in the number of people working in the manufacturing sector in the UK. Now, that was, I think, it's not an exaggeration to think that there was a distinct decision made to tackle the rise of communism in the Labour Party. And there was a war that went on against the trade union movement, and of course, trade unions were concentrated in manufacturing jobs. Well, we can also see that in times of economic stress, the number of people working in manufacturing tends to go down by about 1 million. Well, it's 2.6, well, let's say 2.7 million right now, and whenever there is economic stress or a recession, then manufacturing tends to go down. So, in the next recession, the manufacturing in the UK could be anticipated to just about disappear unless there is clear policy to support it. And then the question arises, well, how will that happen? And what kind of regulation and support for industry is the government willing to really employ? So, what's going on with the pound doesn't really bear a great deal of influence on the FTSE 100 because so many of these shares are internationally oriented. The index, however, is influenced by the currency, and the fact that the pound has been so weak has been a tailwind for the FTSE 100, and when we look at it, it's not so different from a number of those other markets that have broken out. And as long as these breakouts from very long-term ranges are sustained, then we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. It also suggests that the stock market does tend to reflect the inflation rate, and inflationary pressures as a result of the weakness of the currency are rising in the UK. And the stock market is rising with the deterioration of the currency. So I think that's one of the more important points that has helped to support the stock market. Then when we look at government bonds, we have had a substantial contraction in yields, and they are right back at about 1.25. I think one would be very brave to predict that we're going to see a substantial rise when there are so many economic uncertainties that do not yet have an answer. The potential is that UK yields could contract in the event that we go through a period of economic stress, which does highlight, well, one has to ask the question, what on earth was the Bank of England thinking when they raised interest rates? They would appear to be making a political point and ignoring the potential for stress that comes from what we're seeing in the currency markets. But the fact that bonds have been so very steady suggests that the bond market, at least, does not believe that there is going to be a grave source of upset. This is going to represent a volatile environment. The fact that the pound has been trending lower for most of the year, this is a potential source of a counter trend rally right now, but it would really need to sustain a move above the trend mean to really question the overall downward bias. And of course, it's not in the interest to ha for the UK to have a strong currency when there are these questions that remain unanswered. And I think that the UK does represent the the sharp edge of where we have a populist movement that has truly impacted the economic and government policy of a country. Well, it came very close this week in Australia, where Malcolm Turnbull has been ousted, and the centrist Liberal Party, or the centrist wing of the Liberal Party, just about managed to install their own chap. Well, the reality, of course, is that the rise of populism is not a one-off event, it's a trend. And unless they institute the kinds of policies that are going to arrest the rise of populism, well, then we are going to get populists taking over. That Australia has had hasn't had a prime minister that has served a full term in almost a decade. The big question is, has anything really changed? Well, what did change today was the weakness of the dollar has aided the Australian dollar, and it was up by 73 ticks. When we look at that on again on the weekly basis, we can see how consistent the trend on the downside has been for the Aussie. And it does need to break that progression of lower rally highs to confirm more than a short-term low. So I think that's one of the more important points. The fact that the Australian dollar has been weak has helped the mining sector and the gold mining sector do better. But the strength of or the potential for a rally in the Aussie dollar would, I think, perhaps remove some of the protections that the mining sector has had. And therefore, the ability of the industrial and precious metals to rebound is going to be rather important for mining generally. The LME mining index was in positive territory yesterday. And when we look at, for example, just an individual metal like copper, it was in positive territory in here today, but not in an especially dynamic manner. It certainly was oversold, and it has now unwound the big pullback that we saw on the 15th. But it needs to push back up into that overhead trading range. This is still a really rather weak environment. That the it has taken about seven sessions to unwind what it did in one session on the 15th. The best thing that we can say about it is that it has an overextension relative to the trend mean, and it has already had a big move on the downside. But there are still big questions about I think the sustainability of demand, and most particularly demand growth from the Chinese economy. What happens in China is obviously going to have a big knock-on effect for copper. But of course, Australia is a major exporter to China, then the one big obstacle to continued economic expansion in Australia is that China does not continue to grow. Well, when we look at not just the industrial metals, but some of the softer commodities, the Arabica coffee contract has bounced from the 100-cent level on that December contract. Now, if we look at that on a very long-term basis, then we can see that $100 has been an area of support for much of the last decade, and it's a natural area where we can anticipate some support being found. Then, when we look at sugar prices, they are also at an important low, and this 10-cent area is has been an area of both support and resistance over the course of the last 20 years. So it is a natural area where we might anticipate some support starting to come back in. If we look at lumber prices, they have broke up and out of an extraordinarily lengthy and volatile range, and then they've bounced from the $400 level. Well, if the $400 level holds, then we are in a new pricing environment. And That would suggest that the next range is likely to be between 400 and 600, but it absolutely needs to hold that 400 point level, or excuse me, $400 level. And this week it pulled back from the region of the trend mean. So we are now in a period potentially of support building, and that's assuming that the $400 level holds. If it fails, then the potential for the entire accelerated advance to be unwound cannot be, I think, ruled out. Well, when we think about then the outlook for commodities, they're all influenced by what's going on in China. And the fact that, for example, soybeans were in negative territory most of this week and were unable to rally even with some dollar weakness in here today, that continues to highlight that the issue of trade war is not something that has just gone away. Well, there is, of course, the point that if we do get lower commodity prices generally, then that removes an inflationary bias. Of course, the most important of the commodities, which is oil, rallied this week from the region of the trend mean and has broken the downward bias evidence since the beginning, or really the middle of the year. Well, when we think about the role that oil has in the global economy, then the fact that it is continuing to advance is more, I think, a sign that we don't have the massive supply that would help to inhibit price appreciation, that the deterioration that we've seen in places like Venezuela is in, and the sanctions against Iran are taking some supply out of the market, then that is, of course, in the interests of the USA now that it is an energy exporter and less inclined to ensure the security of supply routes from the Middle East, considering that it is now an energy exporter. So that is something that is likely to act as a tailwind for the energy market, and this remains a generally consistent environment. Well, it's not really unless we see oil prices surging higher that they act as an unsurmountable headwind to economic expansion. And they're not accelerating higher right now. That doesn't mean that they won't accelerate higher later. That's a potential outcome from a currently consistently trending environment. Well, if we are entering the third cycle, that's not correct because I think we've been in the third psychological perception stage of this bull market for at least 18 months already. But if we're entering the final stage of the third psychological perception stage of the bull market, then that is likely to be a benefit to the cyclical sector. And commodities are cheap right now. So if they are certainly worth monitoring because there is the potential that they will be able to unwind their oversold conditions and do better. We already can see that the technology sector remains, it's not a relative strength leader at the present moment, but it does continue to exhibit relative strength compared to the market. The smaller cap sector in the USA is definitely breaking higher. The cyclical parts of the market are generally tend to respond to economic growth. And the USA, which is the largest economy, continues to surprise on the upside. So there is the potential that we are going to continue to see the potential for an acceleration improve. If we simply cycle through the lead indicators for future recessions, well, oil prices are not accelerating, high yield spreads are not trending higher, the yield curve spread is not inverted. And the stock markets, particularly Wall Street, remain in reasonably consistent trends. The banking sector, at least the US banking sector, remains in a reasonably consistent uptrend. So we do not have a lead indicator for a recession imminently. And That suggests that in the absence of clear and sustained moves below the trend mean, that we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.